Hi, this is Ellie Bass. Self-Steps is an in-depth study class and discussion of how to grow ourselves using ancient Jewish wisdom and modern-day ideas and research. It's a women's-only class, and all are welcome to join. If you want more information, you can also find us on Facebook at Self-Steps with Ellie Bass. Let's join the episode.
Things and pieces that we don't know. So let's take a look at what Rabbi Sachs is saying here. Because we're always, you know, he's always a good place to go if we're trying to figure it out. And I always feel one of the reasons that I do love reading from Rabbi Sachs is I feel he holds this idea that there are multiple ways to understand things. And you don't get the sense from him that he says, my way is the only way. So now we're on where it says, seeing what isn't there.
Okay,
so I'm going to go through some of this, and then we're going to come back to it. So in Philadelphia, there lives a gentle, gracious, gray-haired man, by now in his late 90s, whom Elaine and I have had the pleasure of meeting several times, and who is one of the most lovely people we've ever known. Many people have reason to be thankful for him because his work has transformed many lives, rescuing people from depression and other debilitating psychological states. His name is Aaron T. Beck, and he's the founder of one of the most effective forms of psychotherapy yet devised, cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, there are many people that will argue about whether or not this is the most effective psychotherapy ever devised. In fact, from what I understand from psychotherapists who actually work with patients on a regular basis, cognitive behavioral therapy is really great for getting somebody out of a very stuck situation, but you also have to process why those cognitive pieces are there in the first place, and that has to do with understanding more deeply who you are and where you come from. So you kind of have to, it's like medication and therapy, right? So if you only take meds and you don't have the therapy, or you only do the therapy and you don't, like, it's trying to figure out what amounts of what things are most important. So CBT is very successful for many people, but ultimately what they see is most of the time they do have to go deeper to really unravel the causes and to dislodge the roots of it.
But it is true that Aaron T. Beck is the one that invented
CBT. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, and it is true that that basically the research shows that therapy and like a form of psychotherapy like CBT together is the most effective treatment for most, like usually it's used, the biggest one is depression.
Right.
That was the classic one it was created for. But that either one is as effective as the other. So if you're not going to do both, then if you're taking meds, it's the same effectiveness as you're doing CBT. So CBT is equal to, but both are together better.
And I think, I wonder if that goes back to this idea, like, you know, when I say community is created or connection is created through consistency, I remember with sleep training, they used to say whatever method you choose is going to be great as long as you're consistent with it.
Absolutely.
So I think in as a healing modality, whatever you choose, if you stick with it, eventually you will see results. Okay, so here's why this is interesting, because specifically he's talking about the spies in relation to cognitive behavioral therapy. All right, so he describes how it works a little bit here. He detected a pattern among his patients. It had to do with the way they interpreted events. They did so in negative ways that were damaging to their self-respect and fatalistic. It was as if they had thought themselves into a condition that one of Beck's most brilliant disciples, Martin Seligman, was later to call learned helplessness. Essentially, they kept telling themselves, I am a failure, nothing I ever try succeeds, I am useless, things will never change. And so we know this now with CBT, it's like thought, feeling, action, and it just becomes this loop. I think this way about myself, then I feel this way about myself, and then I behave this way about myself. And it sort of continues in the loop. And CBT works to interrupt that loop of thought, feeling, action. So let's go down to recall what happened. Moses sent 12 men to spy out the land. The men were leaders, princes of their tribes. It wasn't just anybody that was a spy. These guys were big dudes. Yet 10 of them came back with a demoralizing report. The land, they said, is indeed good. It does flow with milk and honey, but the people are strong. The cities are large and well fortified. Caleb tried to calm the people. We can do it. But the 10 said it could not be done. The people are stronger than we are. They are giants and we are grasshoppers. This is how they describe themselves. And so the terrible event happened. The people lost heart. If only, they said, we had died in Egypt. Let us choose a leader and go back. God became angry. Moses pleaded for mercy. God relented, but insisted that none of that generation, with the sole exceptions of the two dissenting spies, right? So Caleb and Joshua, where are we here? Were right. So Caleb and Joshua would live to enter the land. The people would stay in the wilderness for 40 years, and there they would die. Their children would eventually inherit what might have been theirs had they only had faith. Exactly. Okay, so I wanted to show you, if you turn the page,
I see that explanation as a metaphor for emotional lack of emotional growth. Being there still had a slave mentality that that everything was morphed out of proportion.
Right. Yeah. So we're seeing. So here's what he calls it. I'm just going to read from the bottom of this page and then we'll turn. The spies were terrified of the Canaanites and entirely failed to realize that the Canaanites were terrified of them. Yeah. How could they have made such a profound mistake? For this, we turn to cognitive behavioral therapy and to some of the types of distorted thinking identified by Beck's student, David Burns. So he lists these types of distorted thinking. So I want you to just imagine for a moment as we read through these.
Bless you.
Thank you. If you can think of a person or a situation that's challenging for you right now, if you can just kind of bring that to mind, and as we go through these different types of distorted thinking, see if there's anything that you recognize. So one is all or nothing thinking. Everything is either black or white, good or bad, easy or impossible. That was the spy's verdict on the possibility of conquest. It couldn't be done. There was no room for shading, nuance, complexity. They could have said, it will be difficult. We will need courage and skill, but with God's help, we will prevail. But they did not. Their thinking was a polarized either or. Another is negative filtering. We discount the positives as being insignificant and focus almost exclusively on the negatives. The spies began by noting the positives. The land is good. Look at its fruit. And then came the but. The long string of negatives drowning out the good news and leaving an overwhelmingly negative impression. And sometimes we know, like, ourselves when we're in a certain mood, or our kids when they're in a certain state, or someone we know, that it always ends with a but. That you can never quite finish the conversation on a good note. It kind of just always goes there. And then you're like, oh, I don't know. Like, you just feel like, and it's hard to know how to respond to that, right? Because you want to acknowledge that they're feeling that. But is that really the only perception of reality that can rule in this situation?
No, but for Shalom Bayit, you sometimes just acknowledge their feelings 100%. And walk away.
Absolutely. Of course.
If they're, you know, they're not going to hear you no matter what.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Say.
Yeah. Goes on deaf
ears. Right. One of the ways I do that sometimes with my kids, if they're in that headspace, is like, wow, I'm really sorry that you're feeling that way. That I'm not going to support the evidence that their situation is that, mm-hmm. but that they're feeling that way about it is what needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Right? And then we can find a way out together. A third is catastrophizing, expecting disaster to strike no matter what. That is what the people did when they said, why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us die by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. This is going to be horrible. A fourth is mind reading. We assume we know what other people are thinking, when we are completely wrong because we are jumping to conclusions about them based on our own feelings, not theirs. That's the idea, that you're always coming in the third chapter. You have no idea all the other things that happened 30 seconds before you saw that person, the things that happened in the morning. One of the things that they actually started doing with one of my kids is they'll go in and have a check-in at the office in the morning when they get to school. so that they have a moment to just kind of give a weather report, like, here's where I'm at, this is where I'm, you know, I'm exhausted, I was up late, you know, so that then when, because we always know with one of my kids, when they go into class, if something happens, it's directly related to something that happened before that.
Right.
It's not happening in a vacuum. It's not that they're just like, you know, that kind of person. So whenever they trace it back, it completely diffuses the situation. So now they're proactively just saying, hey, let's check in.
Smart idea.
And what a huge difference,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, one of the things teachers too is to do, if they, because they don't have time
mm-hmm.
often to do,
right.
is just to do thumbs up, thumb middle, thumb down.
Right.
Even just that.
Right.
Someone looking at a child
yeah.
and looking at their thumb.
To know how they're feeling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is, I think, really, really helpful.
Yep.
And it takes a second.
And even with ourselves.
There, where do you go from there? Like, what if a child goes like this fine, but
it's
they
just
go like
acknowledgement.
That? That's it?
It's just acknowledgement.
Yeah, we even with ourselves. Like, if we wake up in the morning and we're
afraid the teacher's going to pick them out to read the paragraph.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
and right.
And everybody's on that. And
yeah.
everybody's
brings your anxiety level down.
Yes.
To be successful the next day.
And
right.
The
right.
other kids.
When you're not feeling great in class when you're a kid. Isn't that true, though, right?
And the other kids, too, know it.
That's right.
They know it. They can see.
But that also is.
Yeah.
Such a good idea.
Integral and honest about it, exactly.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so I think expressing it outward would kind of be the next step. But I think with kids, what we're trying to do is to teach them to recognize it.
Yeah.
Right? So with one of my kids, all it's really, what we're trying to do is give him that recognition and that vocabulary. So eventually, it doesn't have to
yes.
be an outward check-in. It can be, just yeah. be an inward check-in. And we know that with ourselves. If we wake up one morning and we didn't sleep well, right, our stomachs are bothering us, but you have a ton of stuff on your plate that day, right, then, you know, that's not going to be a day we're going to take on an extra project, hopefully,
exactly.
right? It's going to be a day where you got to be a little gentle with yourself. You got to make yourself like a smooth moves tea. And like, you know, try to find a way to like cool
what's
your
a,
system
what's
down,
a
right?
Smooth
right.
Tea.
You know, I learned in
right.
Israel from one of the
right.
girls on our trip. But you're only supposed to take it before you go to
that's
bed.
That's right.
Oh,
good
no,
point.
No,
you
no,
have
no,
it at night.
I don't need that. I need the other one. I need the binding
right.
tea.
You're right.
I need binding, not smooth moves.
So really, you're gonna, you know, you hopefully, and this is really where school, you know, where schools are moving. Where schools are moving towards, I'll bring in a box of smooth moves tea because everybody can
tea.
See it.
It's awful.
So most of the schools and learning environments are moving towards social emotional learning.
Check in, absolutely.
And social emotional learning is really, social emotional learning is really being able to do this. Checking in, knowing where you're at so that it's not affecting how you're acting and how you're thinking and how you're feeling without you even knowing that's what's going on. Right? Because when we're in a state and we don't know we're in a state, that's where things start to go down. Right? I remember actually when I was just after I had my daughter, I read an article that said new mothers who haven't slept for like days on end are actually more dangerous on the road than a drunk driver.
Wow. Worse.
Why? Because they don't know that they're more dangerous on the road than a drunk driver. Because you're so sleep deprived that your response times are down, your ability to make good choices are down. So it was a huge thing for me to realize that and be like, I'm getting in the car with my daughter and I haven't slept in like days.
Yeah.
What am I doing? How do I do this? So it's the not knowing that we're in a state that really often sets us up. So it's just the ability to recognize that these thought distortions are happening, right? So in between stimulus and response lies our freedom and our choice. Recognizing that in this stimulus, it's triggering all kinds of catastrophizing or black and white thinking or all of these pieces. Okay, so without going into all of the other things on this list, we're starting to get the sense that it was thought distortions. The spies went in as spies. They went in with an agenda. They went in already with a lens. The lens of things are going to go bad. It's going to end up the worst. The but, right, that spirals everything down no matter how good things are. So let's turn the page. And I want to look at something here from Pirkei Avot. So one of the things that we talk about with the spies, if we think about a spy that looks at the world through the eyes of a spy, what's one of the things that we understand, a basic concept from Judaism? We have this idea of, everybody's heard of like, iron hara, right? So an evil eye. Excuse me. So this is the idea that someone would look at you when things are good and like, you know, put a hex on you, like, you know, that Schadenfreude, or like, you know, be up, try to make it like, oh, they've got something good. Well, you should know this about them. Like, so ayin hara is like, you want to kind of keep your successes and your joys like kind of toned down because you don't want someone to look at you with an evil eye and affect the outcome in some way, right? So the superstition is that that can happen. And look, like I said, there's all kinds of energies and things like that, but here's what it says about a good eye. So ayin tov is the opposite of ayin hara, right? And so if you turn the page where it says at the top, Pirkei Avot, so this is from Pirkei Avot, which people usually learn during the summer because you have those long Shabbat afternoons with like nothing to do. So Pirkei Avot is the part, we talked about this, the part of the Talmud that totally addresses character development. And so in the summer months, that's usually what people will learn in those long Shabbos afternoons. So from Pirkei Avot, which means ethics of our fathers, or some people translate it as visions of our fathers. So here's the quote from Pirkei Avot. He said to them, "Go out and see which is a good path for a person to attach himself to." What's the best way to live your life? Rabbi Eliezer said, "Ayin tova, a good eye." Rabbi Yehoshua said, "Chaver tov, a good friend." Rabbi Yossi said, "Shechen tov, a good neighbor." Rabbi Shimon said, "One who foresees the outcomes of his actions." And Rabbi Elazar said, "Lev tov, a good heart." He said, I prefer the words of Rabbi Elazar, for included in his words are your words. So he says a good heart encompasses all of these things. If you have a good heart, you'll see with a good eye. If you have a good heart, you'll see as a good friend, a good neighbor, and one who foresees the outcomes of his actions. Is if you have a good heart, you'll evaluate things based on wanting the correct outcome. So how you see is based on how you are in your heart. But let's go down a little bit more, because here we have a little bit of information about Ayin Tova. So part of what the Rabbi Karlinsky is talking about here is that each of these rabbis gave an answer based on their paradigm, the thing that they felt was most important, right? So again, we're learning something about the person based on the words and the ideas that they choose. So for each of these rabbis, these were the things that to them really created a good life. So Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkonas said, "Ayin tova, a good eye." At this point, the author of the Mishnah calls them by title, Rebbe, for they are now teaching halacha, required behavior. Rabbi Eliezer's lesson was built on the foundation with which he possessed. We have already pointed out that Rabbi Eliezer's superior quality was a perfection of his nefesh. He worked on himself, which transcended the natural limitations of his material dimension. This gave him a nefesh tov, a life force that can be considered good. Let's go down. One who possesses a nefesh tov has, so a good life force, has ayin tova, a good and generous eye. Just as one who possesses its opposite, a nefesh ra, right, when you're in a really difficult state, has an ayin ra. So here they say like stingy, but really it's just like you're looking negatively at everything. We find the rabbis making the connection between nefesh ra and ayin ra in numerous times. Let's go to the next page where it says, "In reality." In reality, the power of vision is rooted in the nefesh of the human being, right? So the power of what we see is rooted in who we are. We see that seeing is the most transcendent non-physical of the senses, closest to the spiritual intellectual. There are also textual indications to this connection, both in rabbinic as well as biblical sources. The verb to see is used to describe the activity of the eye, as well as the activity of the mind, right? So when we say, when someone says something and you understand it, oh, I see, mm-hmm. right? There's something, a connection, right? Right. And we find in Kohelet, my heart saw. From all the above, we can see that the power of sight is a transcendent force of the nefesh. And Rebbe Eliezer, whose foundation was built on transcendent nefesh, extolled the Ayin Tova, which is a superior character trait that is generated from such a foundation. And so what he goes on to say is this idea that if you refine yourself, you will be able to have a good eye. And he talks about the soul foundations that we use to refine ourselves. And so that's why I put this on here. He calls them soul forces. But soul forces are exactly what we looked at over the counting of the Omer, right? So if we work on kindness and we work on boundaries and we find truth and we work on persistence and humility, connection and manifestation, these are the soul forces that we're always trying to understand and work out. And if we work on these things, if they are in balance, we have an Ayin Tov. We're able to look at the world through eyes that aren't blighted by our negative perceptions, even though they might be colored by our positive perceptions. But maybe better to color them with the positive than like stain them with the negative. Right? And usually because our minds, we know physiologically, we tend towards the negative, right? It's built into our physiological survival methodology that we think the negative first because we're anticipating safety. So we kind of have to overcompensate with the positive in order to override that. Okay, so let's turn the page. I wanted to give an example of somebody who was understood to be a really beautiful example of having a good eye. So has anybody here ever heard of Henny Machlis or Rabbi Machlis?
Yes.
Okay, so Rabbi Machlis was a rabbi that lived in Jerusalem. He taught, had many students there, and he and his wife, they literally opened their house 24/7, hosted hundreds and hundreds of people for Shabbat. They used to have homeless people sleeping on their couches. I remember a story from one of the rabbis here where he said, like, I went to Rabbi Machlis because a bunch of us at the yeshiva wanted to borrow his van. And he said, you cannot borrow it unless you have it back to my house by 7 p.m. because I give it to people to sleep in. Like, literally, they did not consider anything that they had their own unless they were sharing it. So, and there's so many stories about their house and what that was like, that like they would walk out sometimes. And there was a man on the street once that came up to Rabbi Machlis, thank you, you saved my life, da 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 da. And he was like, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. He was like, I was sleeping on your couch for like 6 months, right? But they just didn't, it wasn't their
so
business
genuine.
Who they were helping, they were just helping. So they're really this incredible example, and they just hosted tons and tons of people in their place. So Henny Machlis, so you Sarah Yocheved Rigler here, it says the Henny Machlis Guide to Character Improvement.
Hmm.
And one of the things, she outlines many of the beautiful characteristics of Henny Machlis, but one of the things she says is a good eye. And here's what she says about her. Many people are critical. They look at a person or a situation and instantly zero in on the defects. In Judaism, the opposite of this trait is called Ayin Tova, a good eye. Ayin Tova assumes that human beings choose what they are, Since in this world it's impossible to see the total picture, people usually make an usually unconscious choice whether to see the good or the bad in the people or situations they encounter. Rabbi Eli Meir, who knew Rebbetzin Machlis for 22 years, declared, I've never seen her ever look at any type of demeanor with negativity. Not at any time was she even slightly negative over anything. Even when something negative happened, she had a positive way of looking at it. So here's someone who knew her. David's story. Her Ayin Tova was unbelievable. She saw that everything is good. It's not like she didn't see the bad. Thank God I merited to spend a lot of time in their house. And I always wondered to myself, doesn't she notice that this guy doesn't have any manners? Doesn't she notice that this guy doesn't understand at all what she's doing for him? Doesn't she understand that this guy's making long business calls back when it was not so cheap and he's trying to do it only when she doesn't see? The truth is that she saw everything. She knew everything. She had very keen insight into human nature and into people. She knew it all. But at the same time, it didn't make any difference whatsoever to her. All she saw was the good. What she did was she saw a person's good and she honed in on that and then defined the person by his good trait. Everything else that was bad, she would not focus on it whatsoever. One time I walked into the house and there were broken cabinets and debris all over the place. I received the usual shalom, but this time it was followed by Baruch Hashem, a pipe burst and it leaked downstairs. But the Baal Shem Tov says, where there's water, there's a blessing. So she was literally able to do this on a regular basis. We don't know her mystery of what was happening inside or how she was able to refrain. But if we imagine that Ayin Tova, like anything, is a muscle, it's something that you have to exercise in order for it to work better, then she was constantly exercising this muscle. If we turn the page, there's one... last story that I wanted us to see. And this goes back to what we were saying about being in control. So turn the page and then one more where it says Rabbi Eliyahu Dershowitz's story. My Auntie Henny never got angry at me. Once when I was 19 years old, she gave me a list of errands to take care of. It was Erev Sukkot, a very busy day. She sent me to buy various foods and challah, and the most important thing she asked me to pick up was Uncle Mordechai's suits from the cleaners. She reminded me several times that all of my uncle's suits were at the cleaners, all of them. She told me, please, Eliyahu, the cleaners close at 2 o'clock, don't forget the suits. I took their car to do the errands. When I came back in the afternoon, Auntie Henny asked me, where are the suits? Did you leave them in the car? And I said, uh-oh, I forgot. It was after 2 p.m. Everything was closed. She just said, okay, beseder. She reacted with total calmness. She didn't get angry at all. She was in total control of herself. Uncle Mordechai didn't have a single suit to wear for the holiday. So Aunt Henny looked up the home number of the owner of the dry cleaners in the phone book, and she called him. He came back and gave her the suits. More than once, I saw people totally blow up at her, yelling and screaming, and she just took it calmly. I never saw her lose it. She told me a lot toward the end of her life that there's no point in getting upset because God is in control. Mm. Okay, high level. High level. And look, this is why she's seen the way that she is, right? This is high level. But the reason we look at high level people is to know what's possible,
right?
It's not to say, oh, I'll never be that, so I'm not even going to try. But we...
But we look, really, we look the real deal.
100%. They were totally the real deal. I saw her speak, and it was quite something. So just sort of, but we look at role models, not because we're necessarily going to be exactly like that. We're going to be exactly like ourselves, but we look at role models to see what's possible, right? And if you can't be it if you can't see it. So when we see it, we go, oh,
right.
I can work on that more. I can aspire to that. It is possible for a human to do that, which means it's possible for me. So when we look at Henny, we allow ourselves to see what's possible if that muscle, the Ayin Tova, is what we exercise the most. And a lot of the time we're exercising the negative unconsciously the most, right? We're kind of going into whatever those spirals are, whatever situation comes up. So to recognize those spirals, I put on the next page a list of cognitive distortions, according to David Burns. So these are really like the 10 things, the ways that we think that just like throw us off track. So the idea is just to recognize, like we said, if we're in a state and don't recognize it, then we're unconscious and we're not making choices. The idea is to at least have choice. So if we can recognize, flag when we go into these cognitive distorted thinking modes, then at least we can say, whoa, I'm in total black and white mode here. This is either going to be good or horrible. That isn't the way that things generally happen. Things are much more nuanced. What can I look for here? So these are the 10 things. So all or nothing thinking, overgeneralization, having a negative mental filter, disqualifying the positive, right, which is what the spies did. Well, it's very nice, it flows with milk and honey, but we're like grasshoppers. Jumping to conclusions, including mind reading and fortune telling, right, which we all think we're very good at, especially when it comes to people that we know well. Magnification or catastrophizing, emotional reasoning, so you're assuming that your negative emotions reflect the way that things really are, right? When we're in a bad mood, everyone's a jerk. Should statements, right? So I should be doing this. This is the way things should be. That whole kind of paradigm, as if we can know objectively how everything should be. Labeling and mislabeling. So I'm a loser, right? This person's a horrible person, right? We're kind of ascribing a finite reality to this person. And personalization. You see yourself as the cause of some negative external event, which in fact you were not primarily responsible for, or you just take everything personally, right? Whereas this specifically says how somebody behaves with you is more about them than it is about you. But if you take everything personally, you never have that experience. You never actually see the person as like, wow, they are really struggling. It's like, oh my gosh, they totally hurt my feelings, or you know, they made me feel terrible, da 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 da. Instead of like, yeah, this has nothing to do with me, they're in pain. And it stops us from being able to do that when we take everything personally. So if we turn the page, this was written by a social worker named Kim Pratt. So she kind of gives the antidotes, right? Positive cognitive choices. So she talks about prioritizing needs over wants. Right? A lot of the time these, we get into, yes. Oh my gosh, I want. And that will often be frustrated. But if we shift into, is this really what I need?
Yep.
Or a lot of the time we'll get into want, but what we're not addressing is actually what we need. I really want a new pair of shoes, but what I really need is to feel deeply connected to another person. Right? And those things can sometimes, okay, a pair of shoes is pretty good, but just saying, like, you know, kind of sometimes, 100%, you can feel deeply connected to the person that's touching your feet. But really, you know, asking the question, is this a want or a need? If it's a need, is this really what I need?
Yeah.
Right? And being able to clarify that will sometimes knock us out of our cognitive distorted thinking. Remove the word should from your vocabulary, right? A simple shift in language like this can be very powerful. Practice, she calls it rainbow thinking, so I guess with pride that really fits. Mm-hmm. But this idea that it's not, life isn't black and white. There's tons of nuance, there's tons of color, there's tons of levels, there's tons of things that we don't necessarily see. And if we just look at the black or the white, the two ends of polar opposites of those scales, it's never that simple, and we're missing nuance. Apply body-mind reasoning. So recognizing when we go into our emotional brain, we're going to think differently. So if we can kind of ground ourselves and not just get caught up in our emotional thinking, it's good to feel our emotions. It's important to understand that emotions don't always make logical choices. And if what's needed in this moment is a logical choice, right? If you just love someone and you want to give them a hug, it's not necessarily a logical choice, but it's one that you can totally follow, right? But if you're angry at somebody and you're just going to hit them, right? Not such a logical choice. What's needed in that moment is your mind and your body. You have to calm yourself down, find a sense of presence, and try to click your brain from the reptilian part of your brain into the ambassador part of your brain. And this is basically what the spies weren't able to do. They completely went into their emotional. Total. Things never work out for us. Total. Things never will be good, right? We've been on this long journey and we'll screw it up. We'll build a golden calf. We're going to be starving in the desert. It was so much better in Egypt. You know, the moment they're saying we should have gone back to Egypt, they're in emotional thinking. They're not thinking straight.
They're not thinking at all.
Right? So the moment you're there, oh, it was so much better when...
Yeah.
You're in a place where you're not really in the present and in reality. Balance positive and negative. So it's important to recognize the negative of a situation, but balance it with seeing the positive also, right? So we're not saying only be positive. It just means like hold the balance between those two things. And sometimes you need more positive to balance out the negative and think clearly. seek to understand rather than assuming. So asking questions. This is what my husband talks about a lot when people talk about Israel, right? Don't get into a fight with them. Ask questions. Why do you think that?
Right.
Why do you believe that? Why do you feel that way? Where did you learn that? Can you show me what you saw? I want to understand more about your ideas. Mm. You know, tell me what you feel or think or experience. So when you get into these hot button issues with another person, right, just yelling at each other your opinions, like we see in American politics right now, like it's just totally unproductive and completely uncomfortable, and it never really feels like anyone's telling the truth. Like I've noticed lately, like I just have a general distrust of media across the board at this point. I feel like everyone's just speaking from their silo. And it's very hard to find people that I feel are really just giving information without bias. So seek to understand, ask questions, try to understand why people are holding the way that they are. Make realistic predictions. So rather than catastrophizing, like this is going to go horrible, the worst possible scenario is going to happen, I can tell you exactly how this is going to go, you know, try to figure it out. Well, usually when I get on a plane, right, there's somebody that's checking it, they've checked my bags, I'm sitting in a seat, they do the whole safety thing. How often, you know, kind of try to back up sometimes that catastrophe mindset with information, because sometimes that alone can calm you down. Just like some, you know, when somebody is feeling like they're not well, my father for months was afraid to go to a doctor before he found out that he had cancer. He was terrified because he knew something was wrong.
Absolutely. Afraid to hear the news.
And we literally had to stage an intervention. You have to go to the doctor because better that you know.
Yep. Then
and you make a plan. Then you don't know, and God forbid something happens, right?
But
he was in that state of not, and my dad's a scientist. This is how he thinks. But he was completely just afraid. So once he went, okay, now we have the information. This is what it is. This is how we're going to deal with it. And thank God he's here still. Like, you know, like if he hadn't gone, it just simply would have eaten him alive, literally. Number 8, don't take anything personally except the compliments. So I like that. Nothing really is personal because it's always being said through a subjective lens. So, you know, it's really great to get amazing compliments. But when somebody's upset, what they're saying is about their upset. And it's important to try to hold that even though you're getting super triggered and annoyed with this person for dumping all their stuff or like that you yourself are upset about something. Cultivate presence. Next time you're in a negative state, ask yourself, is anything bad happening right now? Right? So I, you know, with one of my kids also, like they'll lie in bed and think about all the things that are going to go wrong the next day, right? Or something that happened in the past. And I'm like, you're just in bed now. Like nothing is happening. You're in your bed. Your parents are here. You know, you got your covers, everything. Like right now in this moment, nothing is happening except you getting ready to go to bed. And sometimes it's just that ability to bring yourself present instead of getting caught up in what could happen and what will happen and da-da-da-da, that we, you know, that's why in, not in CBT, in occupational therapy, they'll do these things like where you have to count the tiles or feel the ground under your feet or feel the texture of your couch. You do something physical to just bring you present so you're not spinning off into your mental world.
We count the 5 things off when you're having panic attacks. It's the same thing. It's using one side of your brain to bring you down.
5 things.
Right.
5 things.
Yeah.
I can tell you them afterwards. Or it does work. The other thing is there are anxiety-ridden people.
Yeah,
and therefore, this might apply, and you might be able to take out what works for you.
Yeah.
But there are people that really are. I have a son who is anxiety ridden.
For sure,
right? They're wired that way.
Right.
And so, I don't feed into it, but I don't deny that it's not there.
Yeah,
I acknowledge his anxiety,
and that's what we're saying. If you at least know you're in a state, then you have choice. It doesn't mean the state goes away.
Right.
It doesn't mean the fear goes away. It doesn't mean the anxiety goes away. It doesn't mean
the acknowledgement of it.
But knowing that that's what's going on, rather than just acting out of it, is the first step towards being able to have freedom.
The worst part is not knowing what's going on, because then you keep going and then you lose all equilibrium.
Right, and that's where it gets to defining reality. Yeah. Okay, so last one is be curious. So we always know that curiosity is a good place to go when you're not sure what's really going on. Ask a lot of questions. Ask yourself those questions.
Right.
Am I actually okay? is, you know, am I in a position right now where I could be in danger? And if you don't know the answer, then find out the answers. But being curious will often diffuse arguments, polarization, or these kind of catastrophic types of things.
So why did he use that as a negative? Because it kills kitties.
What's that?
Curiosity killed the cat. Oh.
Well, I think yeah, that,
that's
I mean,
an old one that needs
no,
to be
knowing,
away.
Knowing my old I cat, that I totally one. Understand that.
I never did.
Me neither. Or a good can of tuna. Yes, okay.
I love it. Okay.
Cats actually don't like milk.
Let me just check where we are time-wise. Okay, it's getting late. So I'm not going to go through these last two pieces are really this idea, because where this idea of having a good eye often comes to is, well, can you ever really know the truth? And that productive discomfort that we spoke about in the beginning of, okay, no, we can't, but how do you function from there? Right, so there's an article here about is there absolute objectivity? So by Rabbi Hillel Goldberg, where he goes into a little bit of Jewish philosophy about how we actually understand that the only objective truth that we know is the idea of God and Torah. We're doing our best to connect with objective truth when we learn Torah, to connect with objective ideas of principles and values and morals, but knowing that we are ultimately subjective beings. And so he goes into how we are made up of ideas and emotions and the physical world. Mm-hmm. So how do we try to interpret those experiences through our subjective eyes to connect with some type of objective reality? So he goes over a little bit of that in here, and you can take a look at it. But a lot of what he starts with is this idea that we understand in the story of Yosef and from the Talmud, that a dream, when you have a dream, it's not the dream that dictates what it means, it's the person who interprets it, right? So Yosef, there's a great quote here, which I will read you. Hang on, let me see if I can find it here. The Talmud makes a remarkable statement. All dreams follow the mouth, which means the words of the dream interpreter. That's why it's a serious thing to interpret a dream, right? Because then you're moving that dream state from the potential into the reality. So it says, this is the story in the Talmud. Bar Hadaya made a living interpreting dreams. Abaya, a sage, paid Bar Hadaya to interpret dreams. Rava, another sage, did not pay. Bar Hadaya interpreted Abaya's dreams in a positive light and Rav's dreams in a negative light. And the negative predictions came true. Bar Hadaya did not merely interpret a dream. Rather, it was his interpretation that determined what happened to the dreamer. After Bar Hadaya's bad predictions befell Rava, Rava decided to pay Bar Hadaya, whose interpretation of Rava's dreams turned positive. Rava's fate got better, and Rava told Bar Hadaya, "Wretch, it was in your hands, and you caused me so much pain. Like, if only I'd paid you, you would have given me a better outcome," right? So look, it's a bit of a funny story because they're trying to illustrate an idea, right? They set it up like one of the guys was like, "I get what you're doing, I'm gonna pay you for it," and he gave him a positive interpretation of his dreams. The other guy's like, "I'm not paying you for this," and just like expected him to interpret his dreams, and so we got a negative one, right? So look, we could look into like why is he giving a better prediction to the person who paid him to the person that didn't, but ultimately what we're seeing is, and this is really a deep idea that is understood in many places, especially with the dreams of Yosef, where he interprets the dreams for the people, for the Pharaoh, and when he's in the dungeon, that it's the interpretation that creates its reality. And so what he's talking about here, if we are trying to understand objective truth, that ultimately it goes to this idea of Ayin Tova. How we see things doesn't just interpret reality, it creates reality.
But wasn't there a
famine?
Secret? Don't you think
power
is
more
to it?
There you go.
That's why I never liked.
Oh, I read that book.
Right.
Because
I actually believe
it's coming through the person.
I think it causes the person that hears the news to
turn into
100%. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So where do you think they got it? Like, this is all part of, like, you know, you get what you put out there kind of thing.
Manifest. Yeah. Manifested.
Yeah. We're very careful with that. I also have that the interpretation is coming through a person. So you have to be very careful who you choose. Even when my kids tell me something that they dreamt about, I'm very careful to give them the opportunity to interpret it before I say anything. It's important to allow them to have their own understanding of it without me making something real that maybe isn't real. It's a tremendous responsibility.
But your dreams are, I am convinced your dreams are your reality.
Well,
are they shaping something that's happening? I totally
right. So the Talmud actually says a dream uninterpreted is a letter to the self unopened.
Yeah.
So what we understand is there are things in our dreams are information like any other. And then how we choose to.
But what we do know.
So dreams are a huge part of it. Depends who you are. So many prophets would have their prophecy in dream, right? For Susan, they are.
Yeah.
So many prophets would have their prophecy in dreams.
Yeah.
I think to get to the bottom of what that really means, we could literally do an entire class on it, and I'm happy to do that because it's fascinating for me. But I mean, we see throughout the stories, Jacob lies his head down on the rock, and he has a dream of the ladder that goes up and down from heaven. That dreams are deeply understood to be a way of communication. It's another source of wisdom and information that doesn't come necessarily just from the physical outside world.
Well, I think
if you're involved in it, if it's for you, it's
so
for you.
So I think it. Yeah, so I think it depends who you ask.
And sometimes they're so cuckoo.
You know what?
Right. So I think it depends who you ask.
There's so much that's. You know, when you said between heaven and earth, can I just say briefly? Is that I think that some dreams. I mean, there are people that have gotten answers to experiments. People that have changed their lives and. And even one time I got a dream, and in the dream I could see like my sister sitting up in bed as we used to, and she was really alarmed, but my feeling was everything's fine. And within an hour of me waking up, I get a call from my sister. She's all freaked out because my grandmother isn't answering her door. And I knew from the dream to be fine.
Right.
And she was, so I think we have to be able to step back and realize, I mean, I've had medical answers, etc. Is that it's we're being communicated with, and sometimes it's really, really important. And
so I think Jewishly, I would say it depends who you ask. And I would say psychologically, it depends who you ask. Carl Jung is going to have a very different answer than Freud.
And neurologically,
right?
So we're talking about what neurologists now are saying about dreams.
Right.
Generally, they look at it more as it's an ability for the brain to process memories and information. So for example, they did in wiring kids, like they've done research that shows that if you lose sleep and you have an exam, you're not going to do as well because you're actually processing and learning, assimilating your experiences as you sleep. And
right.
So, like, you know, when they, you know, kids.
Right.
Like,
I'm
going to sleep and I'm going to write an exam.
Right.
It's also such a good approach.
There's an example actually of the guy who created the periodic table.
Yep.
Who for months and months and months he was going through all of the different. For months and months and months, the guy who created the periodic table was going through flashcards, trying to understand how each of the elements related to each other, and eventually he went. Went to sleep, and in a dream, the periodic table snapped into place.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, there's ideas like, was it partly divine? Was it partly processing information? Was it partly he was revealed something?
Yeah.
Was it something he already knew? Right. So, and nobody really knows.
Yeah.
And that's why I think living in that productive discomfort of not actually understanding the whole picture. But I think it's definitely something we can look at through Torah lens. It's information. And how you interact with that information is important because it is information. And we understand, look, even when we talk about our internal environment and our external environment, that both are playing, they're playing to our senses, our emotions, our thoughts, right? If you wake up after you have a disturbing dream, you're kind of like, you're processing that all day, right? Just as if something happened outside of you that would make you feel a little shaky. So it's information, and the question is, how do we understand that information?
Right.
And there's multiple answers about that. Okay, the last thing I want to read before we go, because I know it's 11:30, is I did not put this in your packet, but I just want to read it quickly because I feel like it sort of sums up the idea of what we're talking about. From Rabbi Sacks about another parsha. So here's what he says. The great partnership, that there is a difference between the cause of something and its meaning. So this goes to, like, there's a difference between the dream and the meaning of the dream, right? So if we, just because we don't understand where it came from doesn't mean it isn't meaningful.
Right.
And we see this a lot in Torah. Just because something's irrational doesn't mean it's meaningless. The search for causes is the task of explanation. The search for meaning is the work of interpretation. Science can explain, but it cannot interpret, right? Science can say how, but it never says why. Were the 10 plagues in Egypt a natural sequence of event or divine punishment or both? There's no scientific experiment that could resolve this question. Was the division of the Red Sea a divine intervention in history or a freak easterly wind exposing a submerged and ancient riverbank? Oh. Was the exodus an act of divine liberation or a series of lucky coincidences that allowed a group of fugitive slaves to escape? When all the causal explanations have been given, the quality of miracle, an epoch-changing event in which we see the hand of God, remains. Culture is not nature. There are causes in nature, but only in culture are there meanings. Homo sapiens are uniquely the culture-creating, meaning-seeking animal, and this affects all we do. So here's what I want to leave us with. Viktor Frankl, the psychotherapist who survived Auschwitz, used to emphasize that our lives are determined not by what happened to us, but how we respond to what happens to us. And how we respond depends on how we interpret events. So if we think about the spies, right? What happens, like, how we respond depends on how we interpret events. Is this disaster the end of my world, or is it life calling on me to exercise heroic strength so that I can survive and help others to survive? The same circumstance may be interpreted differently by two people, leading one to despair and the other to heroic endurance. The facts may be the same, but the meanings are diametrically different. How we interpret the world affects how we respond to the world, and it is our responses that shape our lives, individually and correct and collectively. The Ayin Tova it influences how we choose to respond, and our responses create our reality. That is why, in the famous words of Max Dupree, the first responsibility of a leader is to define reality. So when we choose Ayin Tova, we are deciding to define reality based on looking at things through a good eye, by not having cognitive distortions. And what the spies come to show us is that sometimes we allow our cognitive distortions to run away with us, and that creates our reality. It created the reality where they couldn't actually go into the land, and they had to wait for the next generation. So our task is recognize when we're in cognitive distortion and choose Ayin Tova so that we can create a positive reality based on having a good eye. Thank you, everybody. Have a great, wonderful week.
I'm here for my friend.
And I will see you next week. I'll text to see if people are around, and then we'll decide whether we're going to do class or not.
Do you think 4,000 years ago they were as developmentally as we are today, and they would sit around? I know there were religious ones that would sit around and talk about Torah, but do you think that they would sit around